Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call's One Planet series. Last year, the publication of a vast trove of documents obtained through the Freedom of Information Act revealed how, for years, the chemical industry and government regulators understood the extraordinary toxicity of many chemical products, but worked together to conceal the information from the public and the press. The documents known as the Poison Papers were compiled from lawsuits against the Dow Chemical Company, Monsanto, the Environmental Protection Agency, the U.S. Forest Service, and the Air Force. They consist of internal reports and studies, meeting minutes, correspondence, and unsealed court documents, primarily from the 1960s to the 1990s. So what is in these documents? What do they reveal about the relationship between the chemical industry, the EPA, and other government agencies? Today we are joined by Dr. Jonathan Latham, director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes documents of the chemical industry and its regulators. In 2006, Dr. Latham co-founded the Bioscience Resource Project to conduct independent scientific analysis of genetic engineering and its risks. He is also editor of the Independent Science News website. The two aims of the site are to call attention to defects in science and in the science media. And Dr. Jonathan Latham joins us in studio. Hi, Dr. Latham. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. Before we dive in and talk about the Poison Papers, can you tell us a little bit about you, about your background, and why you have dedicated your life and your work to this issue?
So by training, I'm a molecular biologist. So I did a PhD in England. So I'm British. Did a PhD in England in plant virology. And while I was doing that PhD, I used to make GMO crops. So these were not for commercial use. They were for labs, you know, just for our purposes of our experiments to publish in the scientific literature. But I came to realize that the agenda of that research project of molecular biology in plants and in breeding had to do with meeting the needs of plant breeders and multinational corporations. Whereas, you know, what we always imagined was that we would be helping farmers, we would be helping consumers have better quality food and so on. So I realized that there was a mismatch between the agenda that was really being pursued and the agenda that was presented. So, you know, I was a little disillusioned at that point, but it was still a time in those kinds of labs where you could discuss the risks of GMOs and the risks of the kind of projects that we were pursuing. And we had constructive discussions around that. But I came to realize that there were problematic aspects to do with GMOs, for example, that, you know, needed close attention being paid to them. For example, I had a colleague and he was putting basically a toxin into plants in order to make them virus resistant. And he succeeded in making virus resistance. That was incredibly successful. But no one could ever eat that plant, right? Because it contains something that kills basically all living organisms. So there were risk issues. That was clear to me. But many people were arguing, for example, at that time, this is when Flavor Saver tomatoes were coming out. This is the late 1990s when Flavor Saver tomatoes and various beginnings of GMO technology, companies and regulators and governments were basically saying that there were no risks to these technologies. So I could see these kind of political issues surrounding my PhD. You know, I dimly perceived them at the time, I would say. So then what I did was I transitioned into medical research. I went to the University of Wisconsin and I did research that was sort of fundamental medical research. But I could see the same picture was emerging that this was research that whose stated intention was to benefit patients, but whose actual purpose was more to benefit the pharmaceutical industry, develop drugs, benefit the university and academia and so forth. So you see these disconnects between what's claimed to be the purpose and what is really the purpose. So at that point, I left academia. But I came into contact with people who wanted to know more about what's going on in molecular biology, what's going on in biology in general, what's going on with these GMO crops. So I ended up, you know, giving public talks about, you know, risks of GMOs. And one thing led to another. We started a nonprofit, which is the Bioscience Resource Project, to basically share information from people who had an independent voice, you know, like your radio station, right? In a sense, it's like the website for people who are scientists, who have an independent view that is not being picked up neither by the science media nor by the regular media. And so they have really interesting and very important things to say about what is going on. For example, we found a paper, and it was, I was at a conference, and I found this researcher, and they had discovered that 14 pollen grains of GMO maize was enough to kill a butterfly larva.
Wow.
Right? And no one picked up on this research, right? These were actual GMOs that were actually in commercial production, and they were going to be spreading their pollen over the entire countryside. And 14 pollen grains, one maize plant produces probably 1 million pollen grains. And no one's interested in this research. And so, you know, we could really see that there was a need for an organization to share this kind of information.
How do you know when a scientist is independent?
Yeah, the answer is you never know. What you can do is, you know, you can follow a money trail. But, you know, I was at UCSF yesterday talking about these papers. And somebody asked the same question, right? Everyone wants to know this question because you have two kinds of science. Basically, you have kind of science that's bought and paid for, and you may be aware of that because they write it in their conflicts of interest statement at the bottom of the paper, or the journal may not require a scientist to make any such statement, or the scientist may actually deceive the journal, for example. So even the information at the bottom of the paper is not necessarily accurate. There's no one really who verifies that information. So you have two kinds of science. You have people whose science is bought and paid for, and then you have people who are genuinely doing science in the public interest. Yeah. And the problem at the moment in science is there's a huge incentive to publish bought and paid for science. Like anybody who makes any product anywhere at any time needs to promote the effectiveness of that product. You know, whether it's shampoo or GMO foods or whatever it is, they need to promote the effectiveness of that product. But they also need to defend the safety of that product. So you've got all this research on both those fronts that is very, can be very useful to those companies if people consider it independent, right? Everybody knows you don't trust bought and paid for research. So the whole pretense is that, you know, that people attempt, and the incentive is to hide any conflicts that one may have, and they do get hidden. So the actual process is really difficult, because anybody who flags up that they have a conflict of interest, well, their research, they know that their research is going to be thrown in the bin by most people who read it. Mm. So you have this, you know, what I said to the meeting was, you know, the business model of science is conflicts of interest at this point. And so this is, you know, this is basically why we formed our website, to try to get to the bottom of these questions, right? Because you need a lot of experience as a biologist to be able to answer that question, right? I can tell, because I've been in science for a long time and been to a lot of different meetings and pursued all these lines of research over a long period, you know, you start to build up a picture of, you know, there's in a sense a divergence, right? There's people, and at this point, diminishing number, but there's people who are consistently following lines that are in the public interest that to me represent high quality science that actually reflects the real world and is fantastic research. And there are, those people's research all kind of fits in with each other's research. And then there's this kind of corporate model of science, which is pursuing this totally, you know, their stories also add up and they make sense within each other's terms, but the story that they're telling ultimately is wrong. It's about the separation of the organisms from each other, whereas the people who are doing actual public interest research, they talk about the connections between organisms with each other, for example. And those connections are what cause, for example, you know, a chemical pollutant to be released in one place to end up in organisms in a totally other place, like the Arctic, for example. So you've got all these narratives that are common to people who are doing what I would call genuine, you know, public interest science. And it's this whole set of other narratives about, you know, I'll give you an example, like the question of whether things are destroyed in your gut when you eat them, for example. If things are destroyed in your gut, then that basically means that you can eat anything you want, okay? And that means that's a narrative that suits the chemical industry and all these other industries that want to put their products and pollutants and whatever into your food and have you not worry about it. And the people who are doing public interest science, they're basically saying, well, that's not actually true, right? Many things like gluten and so forth, they're not destroyed in your gut. They get into your bloodstream. And sometimes the products of the chemical industry improve the likelihood that these things will get into your gut. And the DNA moves into your bloodstream and the GMO proteins get into your bloodstream and so forth. And so you start to build up a picture of the whole sort of stories between corporate science and actually independent science. But it takes a lot of understanding to do that.
Yes.
And so our job is to try to help that.
And it leaves the citizen with a lot of confusion because there's so many websites, books, debates about these issues. And it's hard for a lot of people who don't have the time to do independent research to figure out what's actually true.
It's a lifetime business in many ways, and the citizen is in many ways defenseless in this battle. And that's why, you know, corporations do this, and governments too, do this kind of manipulation because it works, right? And that's because the citizen is defenseless and often doesn't have a very good science education. Mm. And even people who are very, you know, I meet people who live in the science world, and most people who are full-time academics and haven't seen a lot of the sort of political maneuverings that I spend my time paying attention to, you know, they have this whole idea of objective science. And objective science is a mythology, right? All science comes from some kind of viewpoint. You know, the author is a male and they live in a certain country and they exist at a certain time in history and so on and so forth. There is no ultimately such a thing as objective science. But they promote this mythology, and that means what they think that their view, for example, they will speak as if they are the only person who knows the whole truth and so on and so forth. And so they have this self-image of science, scientists, as being immune from the kind of conflicts of interest that journalists, you know, we all associate with journalism, with politics, and with corporations and so forth. And it's not true. But they like to think of themselves as that, and it's you know, it's also part of the business model. You have to present science as being in some fundamental way objective, and it's not, you know, it's not a criticism of science that scientists are not objective because they have morals, they have ethics, you know, and those come into the picture too. So it's a kind of a complicated story, but you have to get past some of these mythologies to start to understand what's really going on.
Dr. Jonathan Latham co-founded the Bioscience Resource Project in 2006 to conduct independent scientific analysis of genetic engineering and its risks. He's also editor of the Independent Science News website. The two aims of the site are to call attention to defects in science and in the science media. And you can find links to the Bioscience Resource Project and the Independent Science News website at yourcallradio.org. Dr. Latham is also director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes documents of the chemical industry and its regulators. Today is a pre-taped Your Call. We're talking with Dr. Latham as he gives a talk in San Francisco, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. Let's talk about the Poison Papers. First off, how did you get these Poison Papers? The Intercept has been doing really great reporting on this.
Yeah, so there are a few media outlets that actually have reported pretty nicely on these. And there's a Sharon Lerner Intercept article that I would really recommend. It's a nice intro into the story. So, you know, I edit the Independent Science News website. There was a woman who was writing for our website, and her name was Carol Van Strum. And she's not a scientist in terms of having a PhD. But she has a long-term background in activism, and she's a very smart person. And she was actually responsible in many ways for the banning of 2,4-5-T, which is the one half of Agent Orange in the U.S. And her history is that She is still a homesteader in the woods of Oregon. And she was sprayed in the early 1970s. She was sprayed by what turned out to be Agent Orange, by a plane that came over her house, and it her children became sick, her animals died, some of them, and the fish in the river died. You know, it was a really horrific experience. And, you know, from piecing various things together, she realized that it was the spraying that had done this to her family. And there were stories in the valley about how people were having miscarriages and you know, animals with birth defects in the forest and so forth. And so this was Agent Orange being deliberately sprayed in U.S. forests as a weed killer. And so she wanted to know whether EPA and other agencies and corporations knew that their product was toxic, right? Like, if it was really obvious to her, how could it not be obvious to them? So she set out on a kind of odyssey of Freedom of Information Act requests and talking to lawyers and nonprofits who are, you know, in this space and veterans. And so she accumulated this huge trove of information. So her inquiries into Agent Orange led her to the study of dioxins, which were the contaminants that were responsible in many cases for the birth defects that result from the use of Agent Orange. So in Vietnam, people were having birth defects. Vietnam vets were having massive health problems, and many of them were attributable to these dioxin compounds. And these dioxin compounds are not restricted to Agent Orange. They're found in other pesticides. They're found in other products. So the story kind of mushroomed and mushroomed and mushroomed into, you know, collusion and corruption and toxicity of different pesticides and where that all comes from. And so she ends up with this trove of documents. It's nearly 3 tons of paper, 250,000 pages of, you know, incredibly insightful information into how agencies like the EPA go about their business.
Carol Van Strum, as you said, she lived in the forest in Western Oregon. Why was the government spraying Agent Orange over her area?
I mean, the shorthand answer to that is that they'd made a lot of Agent Orange to spray in Vietnam, and the Vietnam War was over, and the companies wanted to keep selling their product.
How common is it for the government to spray Agent Orange in forested areas?
I mean, at that time, it was quite common. And fire breaks and other places would have Agent Orange sprayed in them. So it was used all over the country and in other countries, too.
Can you remind us, what exactly is Agent Orange 2,4,5-T?
So Agent Orange is a mixture of two herbicides, 2,4-D and 2,4,5-T. And partly because of Carol's work, 2,4,5-T was banned, but 2,4-D is still used in agriculture. And actually, I think it's Dow, has produced a new GMO crop, which is resistant to 2,4-D. So they've now started spraying that on fields to kill weeds. And you can basically spray it on top of your food crops in order to kill those weeds.
And as you said, Carol Van Strum's children developed nosebleeds, bloody diarrhea, headaches. Locals described finding animals that either died or had very bizarre deformities, like ducks with backward-facing feet, birds with misshapen beaks, blinded elk. Cats and dogs that had been exposed began bleeding from their eyes and their ears.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and so if you're saying that Agent Orange was used pretty commonly at that time, this happened to, do we have any idea how many people and animals were affected by this and how much land was affected by this?
Yep. I mean, we don't know. We don't know that much. I mean, there are records of what was sprayed to up to a point. But it was widespread. You know, many, many states were using it. Many government agencies were using it. And it was, you know, it was a standard issue weed killer of that time. So it was used on food crops and so on and so forth. So you know, there was very widespread use. You know, the companies have produced a lot of it for the Vietnam War.
Mm-hmm.
So they wanted to keep using that. You know, they developed the plant and the procedures and the marketing and so forth. And it took quite a while for that to be banned.
So, all right. So you got your hands on 250,000 pages. What was the process involved? Who was involved in reading these papers?
So, Carol, she collected them alongside her husband. She also, she collaborated with various people. So there's a fellow called Eric Coppolino. There's also some of the papers come from somebody called Peter von Stackelberg. And there were a couple other people who were, smaller sources of these documents. Essentially, we raised money. So Carol, essentially the story where we come into the story is that about 4 years ago, Carol was writing for our website, and she was making allegations about the EPA, the collusive behavior and appalling things that she claimed that the EPA was doing. And I said to her, we can't publish these allegations unless you can substantiate them. I need to see PDF files of the minutes and the correspondence and so forth between EPA and the companies and et cetera. So, and she couldn't provide that information. So, and I kind of harassed her a bit, surely you have this information. She would say, oh, it's in my barn. It's in my barn. And I said, well, can't you just photocopy these pieces, scan them, and then we can share them on the web, because our readers won't believe what you're saying here. And so she just got tired of my questions, and she didn't publish the article with us. But I was still interested in what was in her barn, so I found out some of the story that I just told you by making some phone calls. So we got together $40,000 to do this scanning project. We raised some money to do that. So we now have produced a website called poisonpapers.org that is basically a repository for those documents, so that people can access them, scan them, journalists can cite them, librarians can look at them, academics can look at them, and piece together parts of the story, because 250,000 pages is a lot of pages. I have not read every one by any means, but I've read certain parts and followed certain stories that particularly interest me. But it makes them available for other people. It was kind of a 4-year process to get that done.
And I'm at the poisonpapers.org website right now, and it says the Poison Papers represent a vast trove of rediscovered chemical industry and regulatory agency documents and correspondence stretching back to the 1920s. Taken as a whole, the papers show that both industry and regulators understood the extraordinary toxicity of many chemical products and work together to conceal this information from the public and the press. These papers will transform our understanding of the hazards posed by certain chemicals on the market and the fraudulence of some of the regulatory processes relied upon to protect human health and the environment. Poisonpapers.org. You can read more about it. Background, you can do a search. And today we are speaking with Dr. Jonathan Latham, director of the Poison Papers Project. In 2006, Dr. Latham co-founded the Bioscience Resource Project to conduct independent scientific analysis of genetic engineering and its risks. He's also editor of the Independent Science News website. The two aims of the site are to call attention to defects in science and in the science media. And Dr. Latham is a trained molecular biologist, and he is in town giving talks about the Poison Papers. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. This is Your Call's One Planet series, and we'll be back after this.
Thank you.
is Your Calls One Planet series. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today we are joined by Dr. Jonathan Latham, director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes 250,000 pages of documents of the chemical industry and regulators. In 2006, Dr. Latham co-founded the Bioscience Resource Project, and he's editor of the Independent Science News website. You can find more information about that, as well as links to the Poison Papers, at yourcallradio.org. Okay, so obviously you could not read the 250,000 pages, but of the pages that you read and of the conversations you had with colleagues who also read the documents, what really stood out for you?
So, you know, there's a whole bunch of stories that to me, help explain the regulatory process that we have in this country, but also, you know, it fits a pattern also with the regulatory process in other countries too. So one of these is that it turns out that EPA has been accepting faulty and fraudulent testing of chemicals. So what happens is they will get a document submitted to them that is the, you know, putative new product from the chemical industry that, you know, they're expecting is going to be a first of a new class of insecticides or herbicides or whatever. And, you know, it comes with a big fanfare and it lands on the desk of EPA. And what often happens is that there's missing data, right? So there's data, toxicological data is missing on some of the animals, is missing on some of the tissues and so on and so forth. So this is an incomplete data set. And so EPA has to decide at that point, is this data set incomplete because the applicant was incompetent? Or is this data set incomplete because the information is being withheld because it would incriminate the product? So what the papers show is that this happens on a routine basis. And so EPA, and EPA is not doing anything about this, right? They're just accepting this data at face value. And so that incriminates them in the process of approval of chemicals that is, you know, they are accepting unacceptable data sets. So there's clearly issues with these data. And that what they should be doing is ordering these tests to be essentially completely redone. But they don't do that, right? And there's many, many things that EPA could do to find out what happened. They could ask a lot of questions. They could audit the labs. They could do any number of things, but they don't do that. And so what you see is this pattern of EPA accepting data. So they had, there are examples, specific examples, and then more generalizable examples that are found in these papers. And this is, you know, extraordinarily worrying because these are many common products in use today.
Tell us about EPA whistleblower William Sanjor, who worked at the EPA for over 30 years.
So he was a branch chief in the hazardous waste division. He was responsible for writing the majority of the hazardous waste regulations. When EPA, during the Carter administration, he was responsible for, you know, there was a whole set of basically companies, you know, there weren't really rules about how to dispose of hazardous waste. So EPA needed to formulate, was tasked by Congress with formulating these rules. And so he essentially tried to write good rules. You know, there was a set of people within the agency who wanted to write good and effective rules, and they had a set of systems for, you know, by which they imagined that the sensible handling of toxic waste would be done. And in part, for example, what they wanted to happen was for companies who produced the waste to be the people responsible for it and to dispose of it themselves. And the logic of this was that you know, a company produces certain waste. You know, each chemical plant or each chemical factory produces certain specific waste, each of which needs to be dealt with in a distinctive way. So their logic was that if those companies have experience with those products and they know how to dispose of them, and as long as they're appropriately regulated, then they will be able to do that in an effective way. But unfortunately, what happened was that the hazardous waste industry, which was a very small industry at that time, kind of you know, exerted undue influence on the waste, on the formulation of these regulations. And he tried to stop them from doing that. And what EPA did was move him into jobs that were non-existent. And so he was basically sidelined from the process because he was trying to achieve a good outcome. And so, but in the process, he was asked to, for example, write loopholes into the legislation. So one of the features that is really important to understand about EPA is that EPA receives laws from Congress, and Congress doesn't say, you know, you should dispose of dioxins in this particular way and in this particular fashion and at this particular time, because Congress doesn't have that expertise. It basically allows EPA a very broad remit to write the regulations that then companies should submit to. But because it has this broad remit, it also provides opportunities for corruption. And what he was asked to do was to write loopholes into the hazardous waste regulations so that EPA would in future never be able to prosecute the people who dispose of hazardous waste improperly. And this was at the behest of the waste management industry, who wanted to do that. So instead of companies, you know, instead of segregating waste of particular kinds into particular sorts so that they could be disposed of in a sensible and I would say scientific fashion, the waste management industry wanted to like put it all together, mix it all up, transport it all over the country, take it to big landfills, which were of unproven effectiveness, basically. And we now know that landfills always basically leak and pollute and so forth. They wanted to create a sort of bureaucratic, complicated, and ultimately unsuccessful version of hazardous waste disposal. So you end up with a situation in which landfills become Superfund sites, and then those Superfund sites have to be emptied and then taken to other landfills that then become Superfund sites in turn because they're leaking as well. So you end up with this endless process of pollution and disposal that benefits the hazardous waste management industry. So the hazardous waste industry has become an enormously profitable business at the expense of the environment and people's health.
William Sanjor, the EPA whistleblower, put a list together of the EPA's revolving door. This is a very partial list of federal officials who have either worked for the waste management industry or left the EPA to work for the industry. And I cannot even name them all because the list is so long. He goes back to 1971, William Ruckelshaus, EPA administrator, who was also a director of Monsanto. Douglas Kossel, EPA administrator, 1977, chairman of Metcalf and Eddy, hazardous waste consultants and Superfund contractor, 1981, 1985. I mean, the list is very, very long. So the question I have for you, because we've had some people who work at the EPA who are really good people trying to do the right thing, protect human health, protect the environment. How do you explain what is happening at the EPA? We'll talk about the EPA under Trump, but I'm talking about past EPAs, where you have these people who worked for industry, but then you also have people who work for government, and that's their full-time entire career. And they're there because they actually believe in the mission of the institution.
To answer that question, there's a reason we got hold of these papers. I wanted to understand Carol's allegations because, you know, if they're true, that means that many environmentalists are campaigning about the wrong things at the wrong times in the wrong place. But it also corresponded with her allegations corresponded with my experience from my GMO work. What I see is EPA and industry people enjoying each other's talks and slapping each other on the back and having these inappropriate relationships. In the meantime, I am explaining ways in which EPA could regulate GMOs more effectively, protect more people, and do a better job. And they're not interested in listening to what I have to say. So what does that tell you about the intentions of the EPA? And I think I know what it tells you about the intentions of the EPA. The EPA does not really have as its primary agenda to protect the public. Its primary agenda is to protect the industries that it regulates. And so we have to delve into these issues in order to understand the logic of this. And there is a logic. And the logic is basically that if you imagine the EPA is quite a small agency in Washington terms, it's not that important. And the head of the EPA serves at the behest of the president. Mm. The president can fire them on a whim. The head of the EPA, so Ruckelshaus, who went to work for the Waste Management Institute, he was the chief administrator of the EPA. He was the head. So basically, the issue is that it's a small agency. If they're going to ban or regulate or sue, for example, major corporations and cost those major corporations major sums of money in foregone sales because the EPA is banning their newest product or their newest lines of products, that decision is not a trivial one. It cannot be made at the lower levels of the agency. It's going to have to be made at the top of the agency. Mm. And as I said, the top of the head of the agency is the only person actually legally who can make these decisions. What that means is that they're going to have to get the approval of the president, or else they, like everyone else in the agency, is going to lose their job if the wrong decision is made. So they have to go to the president, and the president is concerned about many things besides environmental and human health protection in the long term. They're concerned about their re-election and their donors and the economy and pleasing the chemical industry and the banks and the oil industry, all of whose interests will be damaged if EPA bans products worth billions of dollars. So the EPA knows, basically, as an agency, in a collective sense, that if they bring these kinds of questions to the political process, they will lose the argument mm-hmm. in Washington. They cannot win. Because unless the president is an ardent environmentalist and advocate of public health, that they're not going to win. You need that political cover right. in order to make those decisions. So the agency, which operates on very long time spans, right? This is not about the individual administrations that come and go in the White House. This is, a decision that's made will take 3 years, 5 years to actually work through the system. But what everybody at the agency understands, either sometimes consciously, but also unconsciously as well, is that if bad news about these chemicals has to be buried by the agency. Because basically the bad news has to be passed up to the top, and the top doesn't want to hear it. So if you're at the bottom and you know about the toxicological effects of some new compound that's been independently tested, and there's evidence of excess tumors or chronic illness in the tested animals, what are you going to do with that information? Your boss is going to hate you for passing it up to them. Their boss is going to hate them for passing it up. So there's all these incentives in the system to basically minimize the evidence of harm. And so this is what you see in the papers, that scientists at the EPA and administrators sort of have all these sort of pseudo-scientific reasons that they bring into play in order to massage these results to create the illusion of safety. So they have to bring these arguments to bear. And this is partly about the whole issue about being a good person, right, becomes really into this because you don't want to feel yourself you're doing Monsanto's work, right, at the expense of the public. No one wants to believe that. So what happens is the agency develops this culture of using these pseudoscientific arguments to diminish the seeming importance of this data. Because as you say, everybody feels, people who work at EPA, who make, in my opinion, terrible decisions about the balancing public and commercial interest, nevertheless feel that they are ardent environmentalists, that they are good people, and so on and so forth. But they're in a position where either they accept the data at face value or they lose their job. Okay, this is what happens to people. This is why William Sangio became a whistleblower, because mm-hmm. he made that decision and he did the wrong one as far as the agency is concerned. And so therefore, they did everything they could to get rid of him. But the nature of public service is that if you work for the agency, you can only be fired basically on technicalities. And he knew enough about the rules and so forth to not infringe any of those rules. And so he was able to keep his job.
What do you think about, for example, Gina McCarthy, who ran the EPA under the Obama administration?
Mm-hmm.
Any difference?
No.
None. Can you elaborate?
I mean, there are so many agendas in Washington, you know, about the regulation of carbon dioxide and climate change, the regulation of hazardous waste, the regulation of toxic chemicals, the regulation of you know, EPA doesn't go so much into pharmaceuticals, but added food additives, and, or all these chemicals that decisions need to be made about them. These administrators, you know, they have to deal with all kinds of information that's coming to them from various places. And they, you know, the people who have come up through the system, they are inculcated into this culture. Mm. And so, you know, I have discussions with EPA people about the appropriateness of the decisions they make. And they, you know, they appear to believe sincerely that they're making good decisions. Like, you know, for example, they'll find that there's evidence of carcinogenicity. Well, let me think of a very recent example. So let me give you a very recent example, because mostly we're talking about documents from quite a long time ago.
Right.
But my, you know, my real-time experience is very current. So, for example, there's a whole idea that's been discussed in the science media recently of using what's called machine learning and artificial intelligence to improve toxicological testing. And the industry, chemical industry, is pushing this approach. And it sounds really exciting because you can reduce animal testing, the extent of experimentation on animals, by basically substituting machine learning and artificial intelligence for animal testing. So everybody's going to be happy about this, in principle. And I've seen presentations from the chemical industry, for example, or academics who are basically working at the behest of the chemical industry, attempting to convince regulators and academics that this new machine learning approach is a good way to approving new chemicals, evaluating new chemicals. This system is fundamentally flawed because, if, for example, it assumes that if there is a whole series of chemicals that are related to each other, that have already been approved by the government, that if some chemical manufacturer brings a new version of this chemical to the market, that the toxicity of the new version will be roughly the same as the chemical toxicity of the old versions. Now, in my opinion, there's little reason to believe that to be true, because what often happens is companies have access to a whole banks of molecules, and the ones that they brought to the market early are actually the safe ones in their view, and the ones that they've held back previously are actually much more dangerous. But they've held them back for good reasons. But the whole idea of this machine learning thing is that you basically average the toxicity of the things that are already on the market, and you don't include the ones that are not on the market because they're more toxic. But that allows them to bring forward things from their basically their toxic box and put them into the non-toxic box because because the average that's being taken is from the non-toxic box. So this is being proposed, and there's a whole discussion in the science, in scientific journals about what a great idea this is, and it appears to be moving forwards. But it's a fundamentally flawed idea because it basically means there is no possibility. If you just go according to this machine learning process, which is it's a facade. Machine learning is not going on here. It's merely averaging what's already on the market. But if new products are being brought forward, basically there becomes no, if this is the only part of the evaluation process, there is no grounds for any regulator anywhere in the world to basically say no to this chemical, right? Wow. So they're taking it from the toxic box and putting it in the non-toxic box. And regulators are excited about this because it will reduce their workload, and they claim that it will reduce the use of animals, and it will produce more accurate results, and it will use this so-called machine learning system, which is not machine learning at all. That's just a joke. So, but they are excited about this, and so they're making decisions that they, you know, see to themselves as totally logical, which I see is fundamentally flawed and ridiculous. Mm. But they don't see; they're not seeing my argument. Right. And why would they? Because if they stand up to this, they're going to end up you know, having to make difficult decisions about their jobs and so forth.
Dr. Jonathan Latham is director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes thousands, hundreds of thousands of documents of the chemical industry and regulators. Jonathan Latham is in San Francisco giving talks. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take any of your phone calls. You can find out more about his work with the Bioscience Resource Project and the Independent Science News website at yourcallradio.org. One more thing about the EPA, Dr. Latham. I mean, under Trump, you know, they're not even pretending, really. It's the chemical oil industry lobbyists. They're basically running the EPA. As Steve Bannon said, they want to deconstruct the administrative state, so shrink it down to almost nothing. And they're really succeeding because during the first 18 months of the Trump administration, 1,600 workers left the EPA and fewer than 400 were hired. So people are just fleeing that department.
Yeah. So you know, there's complications to this narrative, right? Superficially, it seems like it makes sense. You know, the EPA is overreaching, and Donald Trump, as a conservative, wants to push back on it. But I want to offer you another interpretation of what's going on here. So, as I've said to you, the EPA has been doing the bidding of the chemical industry forever, since it was formed in 1970, basically. You know, there are individuals within the EPA who've pushed back against that at great personal cost to themselves. But for the most part, the employees have gone along with it because, you know, you lose your job if you don't go along with it. So the chemical industry and the oil industry and the waste management industry understand that the EPA has basically been doing their bidding, okay? But if they were to tell the public that the EPA was doing everything they wanted, then the public would have something to say about that, right? The whole purpose of the EPA is not to do what the chemical industry wants. So the chemical industry itself, the oil industry, the regulated industries, have to make a big fuss about how the EPA is overreaching all the time. So they have to propel this narrative that EPA is this, you know, bureaucratic, annoying, you know, is inhibiting their business model, is overreaching in all these different ways and bullying them and so forth. And they have to share this story. And Donald Trump is the kind of president who's bought into this story, right? So he thinks he's doing the chemical industry a favor by putting Scott Pruitt and Andrew Wheeler at the top. Whereas really what he's doing is busting open the narrative and making it actually more difficult for them to get their way, in a sense, in the, you know, he's basically undermining the narrative that this chemical industry, and I think they're probably really annoyed with him for doing that, but, you know, he's his own man in an interesting and bizarre way. And so they don't really have the traction in the White House, right? And so the problem for me is that many environmentalists also are as equally naive as Donald Trump, right? So they are also feeling that the EPA has been helping them defend the public. And what our papers show is that you haven't understood EPA if you think that's really what's going on. So, but they have put, they, you know, our, part of our interest in bringing these papers forward is to explain to environmentalists who are as naive as Donald Trump and who bought into this narrative that really this is not the ultimate truth. That there are much better ways that environmentalists and people concerned about public health should be campaigning to change the way the EPA functions. So we do not think that there should be no EPA. We think that the government has a very important role here to play in protecting the public against toxicological chemicals and the environment from toxins. But what has to happen is the EPA itself, as an agency, has to have the political cover to actually ban products, to actually do its job. What it also has to have is internal incentives for that process to happen, right? The problem at the moment inside the EPA is that all the incentives are to bury the data and to bury the important pieces of information. So that situation has to be reversed. So, for example, consider this simple step. EPA, as I said, writes loopholes into its own regulation. If you were to separate the enforcement functions of EPA from the rulemaking functions of EPA, you would have two separate agencies which couldn't or would have a much harder time in writing loopholes for the other ones to not prosecute. Mm. So there's a simple administrative fix for that problem, right? It's probably not a perfect administrative fix, but it certainly would make it a lot more difficult for that kind of maladministration to happen. So what we recommend is that the EPA is made more independent of the presidency, you know, more in the manner of the Supreme Court, for example. The president cannot fire the judges, right? And that's a good thing because that allows judges to be independent. So the EPA could be made more independent. It could be better funded. It could be separated into rulemaking and enforcement functions. It could be and we could also incentivize whistleblowers. One could actually pay whistleblowers, for example. These are people risking their careers in the public interest, right? It's not surprising there aren't too many whistleblowers. And the reason is because, you know, the whole system works against whistleblowing. If we actually incentivize whistleblowing, you know, provided that whistleblowers could demonstrate that they really had a point, as Bill Sandor did, you know, multiple times before Congress and in court cases, that they really have a good point to make, then we can incentivize them. You know, you don't want people blowing the whistle and making money for no good reason. But as long as they, you know, the judge or somebody could ascertain that these people, that a whistleblower had a good point, we could provide incentives. And I think financial incentives would be totally appropriate because they can no longer work in the EPA, right? They can no longer work anywhere in the industry because, you know, there's so much corruption in environmental toxicology. You know, the number of times I've spoken to people who basically told me that they went to work for an environmental toxicological company, and in their first few weeks at work, you know, they sent in an honest report about the chemical spill or the toxic spill, and they were told, you know, you won't last long in this industry if you bring in reports like that.
Wow.
Right? This happens all the time because there's no incentive for anyone to actually report honestly on these things.
Dr. Jonathan Latham is director of the Poison Papers Project, which publicizes documents of the chemical industry and its regulators. In 2006, Dr. Latham co-founded the Bioscience Resource Project to conduct independent scientific analysis of genetic engineering and its risks. He's also editor of the Independent Science News website. Dr. Latham, thank you for your work and thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Rose.
Thank you. And thanks to Malihe Razazan for producing today's show. You can find more information about the Poison Papers at yourcallradio.org. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call's One Planet series.